This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
Scotland Yard said the body of 30-year-old Bon Scott was discovered by a friend who had left him in the car hours earlier.
You believe in miracles? Yes!
I am your father.
Mount St. Helens has erupted again.
Egan described Gacy as rational, premeditated, and evil, who killed his victims like flies when they got in his way.
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Aaron Camaro and Chris Sinzak.
All right, this one's for the freaks and the Decibel Geeks. Oh yeah, everybody's included. Not always on time, but always worth the wait. Yes, it is the Decibel Geek Podcast. I'm Aaron Camaro, joined as always by Chris Sinzak. My man, how are you feeling?
Good. Ready to open a box full of nostalgia.
Heck yeah, man. This is going to be awesome. Merry Christmas, by the way.
Same to you.
This is going to be a lot of fun, man. It's year in review time again. Mm-hmm. You know it'll always win. And it's always a lot of fun.
It's the only thing that keeps us together.
It's the only thing. It's, you know, the other shows are all great, but this is what makes us feel like we're actually almost teachers in a way, you know, because we go back, we do the research, we work real hard, we bleed and sweat the year we're going to find out about, we're going to pass on the information to you. And this is a damn good one.
Yeah.
This is a really good one because this kicks off a decade that just may be the best decade in rock and roll history.
It's a good argument for it.
Yeah, for sure. So today we're going back to 1980.
That's right. I've been trying skinny ties on all week. It just doesn't look right on me, though. I don't know.
I'm wearing less makeup, but then more makeup.
Right.
Yeah. So it's all the same. It's just different colors.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we've got a lot to get to. Let's take care of some business first. We need to acknowledge the Geeks of the Week this week.
Heck yeah, always our Geeks of the Week. These are the people out there in the internet world. They're sharing the word of Decibel Geek. How do we grow? It's grassroots. People get out there and they say, man, this is a really cool podcast I heard about, and I want you to hear about it too. And these guys are on here, and they come up every single week. They never let us down. They're always there. It's always free, and they're always talking about my favorite bands. Hard rock, classic metal, we got you covered. So if you're out there on Facebook or you're on Twitter, you want to share it or retweet it, then you become a Geek of the Week.
That's right. And these are the people that shared on Facebook and retweeted on Twitter. Last week's Radio Sucks Radio Show, Volume 23, that one went over well.
Yeah, man, and a lot of fun. It was nice to kind of relax for a minute before we dove into what we're getting into
today.
Yeah,
we got a lot on our plate today. So Geeks of the Week this week are Matt Ashcraft, Rosita Mark, Mike Stewart, Joe Royland, Sit and Spin with Joe, Brant Cattell, Gregory Muse, Covers and Fire Podcast, Cal Hens, Matt Bradshaw, Denise Garcia Spear, Kevin Williams, Michael Bartley, Rockin' Ron Runyon, Ian Wadley, the Rock and Metal Combat Podcast, Brian Knapp, Joe Lascon, Billy Hardaway, Kenneth McDonald, Joey Vancieri, Anthony Poole, Wayne Cross, Spencer Wetmore, Stacey Sullivan, Trevor McDougall, David Alpizar, Mark Taylor, Greg McGlone, Unknown Elements, Obscure Rock and Metal, Billy Hardcore, Adam Cox, Ernesto Aguiar, Mikhail Burrell, Daniel Chappett, Colin Francis, Ken Chase, the Mooger Fugger, Jay Shablewski, LA Knights, Nonaka, Thunder and Lightning, Nick Rose, and Derek Novak.
Not just Thunder, but Thunder and Lightning. Both of them.
That's right.
That's awesome.
We might be dealing with some of that while we record tonight.
Yeah, we got some tornado warnings going on, but we're here in the studio, and we have faith that the rock and roll will protect us tonight.
It's Christmas time in Tennessee, and it's 70 degrees outside,
and a
tornado is coming through.
Yeah, it's, wow.
Yeah.
That's Tennessee for you.
It totally is.
So if we're going to talk about 1980, there's only one place to start. It's the place we always start when we do our year in reviews. It's a nice little retrospective that Chris always gives us the information on. So lay it on us.
Yeah, and it's usually we go back a quite a few years, so it's numbers that kind of make you go, wow.
Yeah.
I wish I could go back to that time. So like such as average cost of a new house in 1980 is $68,700.
See, not bad at all, you know. 1980, sweet.
The average monthly rent was $300.
You can't rent nothing for $300. You can't rent a cardboard box for $300 a month.
Mm-mm, not usually. The cost of a gallon of gas is $1.19.
Can you imagine filling up the tank and having it last a month?
Yeah, no kidding. And the all-important, most important stat of 1980, the price of bacon was $1.45 per pound.
I'm ready to go back. I'm ready
Me
to go
too.
Back right now after
but
hearing that.
It wasn't all roses. Let's look at some what I call what-the-fuck prices
okay.
from 1980. A Magnavox VHS recorder was $699.
That's funny. And you had to send away to Japan to get it?
I don't know. And then a VHS home movie camera was $1,599.
That's crazy, because it was new cutting-edge technology at that time. So only, you know, you had to pay big bucks to have that. Not everybody had a VCR when they first came out. It wasn't until they were made in a better way a few years later that, you know, where everybody could get one.
I don't remember getting our first VCR till maybe 84.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking,
first
too.
First time I went to a video store, too. And looked around, I was like, wow, look at all these boxes with these movies I've seen
that
I want to see.
That I've always wanted to see, that other people have talked about. And to me, it was, I'll never forget going into the VHS store for the first time, the rental place, and going in and looking around and being blown away. And I'm looking, and here's a movie we're going to be talking about here in the next 2 weeks. There it is. Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, we will get to that in the show today.
I'd never seen it until my parents were able to go to a store, rent a VCR, and some VHS tapes to take home for the weekend.
That's similar to my memory of the back corner of a video store. It was always my favorite part of the video
back
store.
Back sneaking behind the curtain?
Yeah. Boobies!
Yeah, I believe that to be true.
All right, so let's get into it. We're going to cover January through May today.
Yeah, and it's all, you know, as it always is, through the eyes of rock and roll. So starting out things out in the beginning of the year on January 16th, Paul McCartney's busted with a half pound of weed in Tokyo, Japan.
He was turning Japanese.
Yeah, he was. He's detained in the country for about a week, and then he's kicked out, deported, forcing the cancellation of the rest of the tour. And ultimately, that's the end of the band Wings, too, because they never really reunite after that.
Yeah, I think they were just looking for an excuse to break up anyway. I mean, they kind of run their course by that time. And I mean,
that's a good one. And think about how differently marijuana was viewed back in 1980 the war on drugs. And, well, I suppose that's not quite happened yet, but it's coming.
It's close to Just Say No time.
Right.
But I mean, what the fuck is Paul McCartney thinking? He had to have known that was a bad idea.
They were waiting for him as soon as he got off the plane.
A half pound of dope? What do you get? At least have a roadie carry it for you and let him take the fall for it.
I suppose he just figured, you know, what do? You know, you're going to Japan. Nobody in Japan's got any weed. Where am I going to get it from?
Well, I'm sure they got weed in Japan.
It's probably really damn good, too.
Yeah, I would think so. But yeah, yeah. Paul McCartney, half pound of dope.
Should have held off for the Japanese reefer.
Yeah. So I guess I'll do the first pick of the show. We're in January, and first pick of the show is by a band named Girl.
Right on. We were just talking about this not too long ago.
They were I think they were a British band, and their debut album came out in January. It was released on Jet Records. The band included some notable names that you've heard of. Phil Collin on guitar, who wound up with Def Leppard. And then the singer was Phil Lewis, who, of course, fronted L.A. Guns.
Oh, wow. I didn't know.
Notably from this album, usually the only song people really ever bring up from this album is their cover of Do You Love Me by Kiss. They're a UK band. And remember, Kiss played Wembley Stadium in 1980. And Iron Maiden was the opening band.
Right.
But I think it was like on the off night, like one of those nights, Girl was the opening band.
Yeah, who were we talking about with that recently? Who wrote the book?
Chris Hepning or
Yeah, it was Chris. Yeah, it was Chris Etting on the...
Because Phil was in that band. He helped with Phil with his memoir.
Right, and how it came full circle because the girl had opened up for Kiss back in the day, and then now, recently, in recent times, Def Leppard has opened for him, so it came full circle for him.
And they performed Do You Love Me when they opened for Kiss. I think I heard that it pissed the band off or something like that. But I wanted to play something else from that album, and... this song, I think Aaron knows, because this song actually wound up on LA Guns' first album, but this is the original version. This is Girl with Hollywood Tease.
About any of that. That's very cool.
Yeah, that's a LA Guns song like years before LA Guns even existed.
And what's the album called?
I think it's just called Girl. No, actually it's called Sheer Greed.
Sheer Greed. I'll have to look that up. I'd like to hear some more of that.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
All right. Well, that brings us into February. You know, and we always kind of bring up this stuff because it's funny. It ain't funny. It's scary to look back on some of the crazy things that were going on in our year in reviews. And 1980 was the year that John Wayne Gacy, yes, the first juggalo, was convicted of and found guilty in 33 murders. And I think everybody knows how effed up that story was. So then they also had one called the Sacramento Vampire. And this guy was a murderous necrophiliac cannibal, and he was captured and convicted of 6 counts of murder.
See, I never heard of that one.
No, it's crazy, man. That's a crazy story, too. I was just looking up 1980 news, you know, and that's the kind of shitty stuff that comes up.
He picked the wrong evil identity. You know, I guess clowns were bigger in 1980, so Gacy got more press.
Yeah, he did. So the first juggalo is a better killer, I guess, than the Sacramento Vampire, because who have you heard of? Strange. All right, well, I guess no better place to get the hell out of that stuff and get back to the rock and roll. And, you know, Heart was a band that enjoyed, like, 2 great waves of success. Absolutely. You know what I mean? Initially as the hard rockin' band led by the Wilson Sisters during the 70s, and then again as, like, the radio-friendly unit shifter of the 80s that they were, of course. That's part of what makes the Baby LaStrange album so interesting, because what else is LaStrange is when an album that peaks at number 5 on the U.S. album charts and stays there for 22 weeks is considered a letdown.
Yeah.
But then again, it's tough to follow up the mega success of Dog and Butterfly and Little Queen, you know, huge albums. So this may be the first Heart album to kick off the decade of the 80s, but it definitely fits in better with the band's earlier 70s work. Final Heart CD in my heart in my collection.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. You know, the rest of their catalog, you know, it's got some songs I like, but never any complete rockin' albums, you know. I might go one more if I could find it, 1982's Private Audition on CD, but
yeah, that's probably good luck with that. Baby LaStrange is a good record, but it's good. There's some real dark material on that too.
Yeah, because at that time they're huge stars and they're seeing the rise and the fall and all that, and the change is coming, and it's still a great album. This one, like I said, it fits definitely with the earlier original style of Heart. That's the stuff I like.
Yeah. I like both, but yeah, I hear what you're saying. Then February 7th, Pink Floyd kicks off the infamous tour for The Wall at the LA Memorial Sports Arena.
Yeah, and that was a huge deal. They set a standard for concerts. You know, you look at Kiss before that with the explosions and all that, but think about the Wall tour with the building of the wall and the different things going on. Just an entire experience.
Yeah. That's one of those where if I could go back in time and see the original, you know, touring version of that, it would have been really awesome.
Yeah, that'd be a good one for the time machine. Envious of anybody that got to see that in 1980.
Grew to appreciate Pink Floyd more after we did that episode on.
Yeah, The Heavier Side of Floyd.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
If you doubt the power of Pink Floyd, go back and check out that episode.
It's good stuff. Okay, so one of my favorite bands released what is my favorite record by that band on February 4th of 1980. The Ramones put out End of the Century, which I know a lot of diehard Ramones fans are now like cackling or throwing up after me just saying it's my favorite album by them. Because this is I guess what some people would call the sellout record that the Ramones did.
Yeah.
Like they get Phil Spector on board to produce the album. And, you know, Phil Spector is going to bring the Phil Spector sound, which is like, 60s era, wall of sound and girl group type stuff, like poppy stuff.
Sure,
a lot
of
melodies. Of And they brought it on, but I thought it was a stroke of genius. I love the early Ramone stuff, too. I love the chainsaw guitar stuff. I don't take anything away from that.
But at this point, they're a band for a long time, and they're finally trying to make some scratch.
Yeah, they're like really trying to hit the charts. This was them really going for it.
Like, everybody respects them, but that ain't paying the bills.
Right. So they bring in Phil Spector, and they go to his studio, and if you don't know the story, the condensed version is, Phil Spector, while he's a genius producer, is insane, and which is probably why he's rotting away in a prison cell for killing somebody right now.
That's true.
But he would carry guns into the studio. He would threaten to shoot people all the time.
I said, play it correctly.
Right. Oh God, the story about him trying to get Johnny to hit that one right open chord at the beginning of Rock and Roll High School is insane. He made him record that one open chord like 300 times and would like rant and stomp around the studio and curse and go nuts over it. And then the rest of the band hated him because Phil was obsessed with Joey Ramone and like was everything was Joey. He wanted to make Joey Ramone into a star. And the rest of the band was like, well, fuck you. He treated the band like they were side musicians.
The rest of our last names are Ramone, too, you know?
Yeah, dude. But the album came out, has a lot of great songs on it, and I think it's highly underrated because it should have been a hit. But this is a song that has still some of that early Ramone spirit, but also has the Phil Spector production in it. This Ain't Havana.
Yes.
Do you like bananas?
I love bananas.
Okay, good. That answers that question.
That's cool, man. Yeah, if you like the Ramones, you definitely owe it to yourself to check that one out.
Yeah, I love that album.
Good stuff from 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Bad stuff from 1980? Well, it came to us on February 13th, and it's a day it just hurts rock and roll forever, and that's the day we lost the immortal, should have been, wish he would have been, Bon Scott.
Yeah.
But what a bummer, you know? The guy, hard partying, you know?
Yeah,
that love that AC/DC, the early stuff, so much, you know? And these guys were really, man, they were almost there. They were literally on the cusp in 1980, you know? Had Bon Scott lived, I gotta believe that Back in Black would have been just as big of an album, if not bigger, you know? So close, and it just slipped away.
And it's not the way you want to go. Just basically froze to death in a car. I mean,
Terrible.
Yeah, it's a scary situation, but the guy, you know, left a lasting legacy of music for all of us, which we've celebrated numerous times on the show.
Oh, and we'll continue to for as long as we do the show. Yeah. We'll always pay homage to Bon Scott and his contributions to rock and roll history and AC/DC and the amazing music they all created together. Sad times. Well, 1980s a year of sad deaths, especially in rock and roll.
Yeah, you got to cover it. I mean, it's a big part of the year. And then, but then some good stuff happened for America on February 22nd.
Yeah, they had the Olympic ice hockey game, the Miracle on Ice. It took place in 1980 at Lake Placid, the Winter Olympics. And it was called the Miracle on Ice because the U.S. team was made up of mostly college-level players, and they were playing against the Soviet Union, who was considered one of the greatest ice hockey teams ever assembled. And so it came down to it, and the U.S. beat them by one goal.
Yep, 4-3.
And they were a bunch of just scrub college guys, but they had heart and a really good coach from what I read up on it. And they've made movies out of it, out of the story of it and all that, man. Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool. And everybody always remember that for the call, you know, do you believe in miracles? Yeah. And then later on, call it the Miracle on Ice. You know, it's pretty cool. Then the U.S. goes on, they beat Finland and they bring home the gold. And that was the second time the U.S. had ever brought home the gold in hockey.
It was a big deal.
Real big deal.
I still remember my parents telling me about, you know, watching it. I was too young to remember it.
But yeah, me too.
My parents always used to talk about that.
You know what I like to talk about? Van Halen. Heck yeah, and if it's 1980, I can't think of anybody better to talk about. You know, the mighty Van Halen, they just wrapped up their world vacation tour, and it's almost immediately, bam, back into the studio to work on their third studio album, Women and Children First. It marks a slightly darker sound and lyrics than the first two albums. I think you'd agree with that. The story is that the rift between Ed and Dave really started to open up around this time. Obviously, musically, Ed wanted to make more serious tones and sounds and, you know, get away from the good time party music, but that's what Dave is good at. It wasn't all Eddie's control freaking, though, because Dave was known to be a limelight hog at the time. Even the photo session for the album cover was a huge ordeal. You ever heard the story about that?
Yeah.
Oh, man, what a mess. Maybe it's the undercurrent of conflict that breeds creation for one of the greatest albums of the year. And then as soon as it's released, Van Halen embarks on the massive Party Till You Die World Invasion Tour. And it's just another fine example of what the classic lineup of Van Halen, you know, what makes them so stellar.
Yeah, if you saw them at that period, I'm incredibly jealous of you.
Yeah, man. That music is awesome. That album is killer. Ah, you know what? Album of the year, 1980. Mm. That's what I'm saying.
And good friend of the show, Robert Fleischman, was an opening act on that tour.
Yeah? Wow, that's right. Yeah, cool.
Must have been a hell of a show.
Oh, man, I can imagine.
All right, so, you know, Van Halen, known as, you know, gods of hard rock music, and they're happy to admit that. Let's go to a band that is not happy to admit that they're a hard rock band for some weird reason. I'm talking about Def Leppard.
What do they think they are?
Death
metal?
Well, no, they like to...
We're death metal.
No, they want to put themselves up as like a pop band. Like,
yeah.
And maybe they have been since Hysteria. I guess you could say they have. But early on, man, they were a hard rock band or, you know, new wave of British heavy metal band. They were in that league.
We just talked about this on Versus for the VIPs. We'll know about that. Mm-hmm. And I still stand by my guns with this. Def Leppard, you know, when Stevie Clark died, he took the balls of the leopard with him.
Yeah.
But back in 1980, Steve Clark was alive and well.
He was, and Pete Willis was in the band at the time, too. This was pre-Phil Collins.
Yeah, because he was in Girl.
Yep. And Pete Willis was the other guitar player. They put out On Through the Night, which was their debut album, released on Vertigo Mercury Records on March 14th, and produced by Tom Allom, who did tons of stuff with Judas Priest and other bands. He was kind of the in-demand producer for the new wave of British heavy metal at the time. And Def Leppard was one of those bands, whether they want to admit it now or not, that was their original sound. And this song is a great testament to that early sound of Def Leppard. This is Def Leppard with Wasted. Song by a band that now plays for Housewives.
Yeah, it's true. You know,
really not going to get that Def Leppard interview, but sorry.
We'll hold out for Steve.
Speaking of our best of 2015 upcoming episode, don't expect to hear any Def Leppard.
No,
biggest disappointments I've heard.
Yeah. Well, speaking of big changes, there's fewer better examples of a band having one foot in the 70s and the other planted in the 80s than Scorpions' seventh album, Animal Magnetism. It shows a band that's tied to its blues rock roots, but you also see the future being bright for arena rockers and ballads. Mm-hmm. They see it. It's coming. You know, after losing Uli John Roth as lead guitarist in 1978 and replacing him with a young hotshot named Matthias Jabs, on his first album he had to share the duties with one and only Michael Schenker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's got to be tough to be the new guitarist, and all of a sudden it was like, oh, yeah, this amazing dude's going to come in and lay some of this down. But when it comes to Animal Magnetism, totally the Jabs show.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, this is an awesome album. You got to love the just slightly suggestively lewd album cover. It's subliminal enough to get past the American Morality Squad in 1980. This one, it's a truly transitional album that I think should satisfy every Scorpions fan.
How are you holding up?
I'm all right.
Want to go for 10 miles?
If you make it, I'll buy you a beer.
If we make it, I'll buy you a lone brow.
When you want the taste of a truly great American beer, tonight, let it be lone brow.
Tonight, let it be lone brow.
Pontiac introduces the first turbocharged V8 of the 80s. Available only in Trans Am or Formula Firebird. With power swelling out of the hood and telling the world where it's at. A 4.9-liter message of appreciation to true believers. The way Pontiac knows how to deliver it. The world's only turbocharged V8 available in a production car. Now that's more Pontiac excitement for the great ones.
Right, you are listening to the Decibel Geek Podcast as we travel back in time to the year that was 1980. And what a year it was. Let's take a break from the rock and roll just for a moment. Just for a second. We'll get back to what we promised. And let's talk about some of the big movies of 1980.
This was a golden age because Aaron and I were little kids when this happened. So
a lot
of these are really important to us.
I remember most of these movies.
I remember all of them.
So at number 10... Obviously, I think everybody knows this one, The Blues Brothers.
I can't believe that was number 10.
Yeah.
I thought it would have ranked higher than that.
Well, I mean, it's got a lot of competition in 1980 because a lot of movies that I look at this list I consider to be classics.
But Blues Brothers has both kinds of music in it, country and Western.
It sure does. Coming in at number 9 in 1980, The Blue Lagoon.
Mm-hmm.
Remember
Shields.
That one? Brooke Shields. Underage Brooke Shields. I remember people talking about, you know, that was weird back then.
Nobody gets between her and her Jordache.
No, I guess not.
Especially that creepy perv around the corner.
At number 8, you got Smokey and the Bandit 2.
Mm-hmm.
Number 7, Coal Miner's Daughter. Mm-hmm. That's a famous film everybody still talks about. Number 6, Private Benjamin. Remember this one? Yeah, Goldie Hawn was in that. I remember that from being a little kid when VHS tapes came out. We could finally afford to get them. Number 5, Any Which Way You Can. I don't know a whole lot about that one.
Right Turn, Clyde. That's Clint Eastwood and the Monkey.
Oh, so that's part two of Any Which Way But Loose.
Every Which Way But Loose and Any Which Way You Can.
Oh, okay, nice.
Yeah.
I got to get those on. I got to break out the old VHS player.
The Clint Eastwood White Trash Collection.
I got to get a VCR. Start going to yard sales and looking for these movies from 1980. Movies like number 4, Airplane.
My brother
that's
and
a
I
classic.
Were obsessed with that movie.
Oh, God, that's a great movie. I laugh so hard even today.
It's a great
movie.
And
all the sequels that it spawned. And the classic, it all started in 1980. All right, at number 3, Stir Crazy.
Yep.
That's an amazingly funny movie.
Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder.
Hell yeah. What a team those guys are, man. There's a lot of great comedy duos throughout history, but man, that's the shit right there. At number 2, you got 9 to 5. Mm. That was a Dolly Parton movie, right?
Dolly Parton and Lily Tomlin, and then Dabney Coleman played the boss, who was a complete scumbag. And,
that's right.
That's a funny movie.
Man, see, this...
Right in the middle of the women's lib movement.
Right, yeah. So this list is awesome. It makes me want to go back and watch these movies like today, because they're all such amazing movies. And of course, if you're talking about the year 1980, the number 1 movie... Hey, we got something in common.
Herbie Goes Bananas.
Well, obviously.
No, I'm just kidding.
We got a lot in common with 1980 this week. Yeah, it's 2015, and with 1980, we share the number 1 movie is Star Wars. But in 1980, it was The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
Oh, man. For the longest time, and maybe still, I think that's my favorite of the Star Wars movies.
It's many people's favorite.
Yeah, it's just so awesome. The ice battles, and then, you just can't beat that. And then Luke finds out. He's his father.
Don't spoil it, man.
Oh, shit.
Somebody, one of our listeners may have been in a coma for like the last 40 years.
I know, it's such a big thing to make sure you don't spoil the Star Wars. So I'm just going to go ahead and say Empire Strikes Back, thumbs up.
Yeah.
Good movie. Go see it. Highly recommended.
And then other movies that year?
Yeah, Caddyshack. That didn't make the top 10, but that's a classic. Mm. The Elephant Man, you ever seen that?
Yeah.
That's a crazy story based on a true story.
Disturbing movie.
The Shining. Oh. Everybody knows that one. Here's Johnny. That's a good one. The very first Friday the 13th.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a classic. You ever see Alligator?
I've forgotten about it.
It's like Alligator in the Sewer. It's a little baby alligator. They flush it down the toilet, and then later on it's this gargantuan, mutated, large, huge alligator.
I'll have to check that
out. Killing people. I'm sure it's probably not as good as I remember it being as far as, effects go and stuff. But
yeah,
I remember being terrified of it when I was a kid.
I'll have to check that one out.
Raging Bull came out in 1980.
That's a great movie.
Yeah, Flash Gordon, mm-hmm. Popeye.
Queen did the soundtrack for Flash
That's
Gordon.
Right, yeah. Probably hear some Queen in this one, huh?
Maybe.
All right, stick around for that. Popeye with Robin Williams, yeah. The live action. I remember that as a kid.
I went to the theater to see it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I did too. Nice. Yeah. See, that's why we're bros on the Decibel Geek
podcast.
It
was you and me and maybe three other people that went
our parents,
it.
Yeah, that's it. And Superman 2, mm-hmm. which was pretty
cool.
Yeah, I love
all these movies.
Yeah, these are all great movies. So there you go. That's your collection to go back and go to Netflix or now whatever you got going on nowadays.
Yeah,
dust off the VCR, pull out the VHS, and enjoy those movies because they're all awesome.
And then, so we're in March, and Journey on March 23rd puts out Departure. And this is when they were really getting their legs with Steve Perry singing for them. This is their sixth studio album released on Columbia Records. The last Journey album for original member Greg Raleigh. He had become tired of life on the road and decided to leave the band after assisting in the selection of his replacement, Jonathan Cain, who was from the band The Babies. But this album is what the title says. It's a departure, and this was them kind of commercializing their sound. And this is a track called Where Were You? Game you can play, and I didn't have time to edit the clip together.
All right.
Doing the research for this episode, a lot of different types of albums came out this year, and another album, which we'll talk about later, is British Steel by Judas Priest.
Yeah, I think that'll probably come back up.
It will. And listen to the intro to that song, Where Were You, and uh-huh. then listen to You Don't Have to Be Old to Be Wise by Judas Priest.
Hmm.
And you'll get a good laugh.
Huh.
Well, two very different bands.
There's a fun little game you can play.
Yeah.
In 1980, Aerosmith had pretty much imploded after the infamous World Series of Rock show at the Cleveland Stadium in July of 1979. Mm-hmm. That's the famous one where Joe Perry walks out on the band or was fired by Steven, depending on who you ask. Perry's departure would leave the album Night in the Ruts unfinished.
Love that album.
Yeah, it's a good one, but it would be completed with some replacement players. Mm-hmm. Perry even took some of the songs with him, and with a chip on his shoulder to prove to his former band that he could do it without them, he quickly formed the Joe Perry Project and released the 1980 album Let the Music Do the Talking. It's kind of funny that Joe started putting this band together before Aerosmith, even before he even brought up thinking about leaving Aerosmith.
It was just going to be a side project.
It was, I don't know, he probably knew.
He knew.
You know, it's like, okay.
Oh, God, once Reed walked this way.
Once I get it together enough, then I'll just let him know I quit.
Some venom, night. Man. Jeez.
Yeah, that was a crazy situation. You know, once it was official that he was out of the band, he was immediately re-signed by Aerosmith's label CBS in an attempt to kind of keep the family together in hopes that one day maybe they'd reunite. Mm-hmm. Maybe, possibly. With Ronnie Stewart on drums, David Hull on bass, Perry recruited Ralph Mormon to share lead vocal duties with him in the band. Mormon would only last until June before he's fired and replaced by New York City vocalist Joey Mala. Look back at the Sherbach episode. Mm-hmm. Here's the hear about Joey Mala. And eventually he's replaced by Charlie Farron. And the Joe Perry Project would release two more albums before Joe would eventually end up reuniting with Aerosmith in 1984.
So which one of the singers is singing on that track?
On that track,
Ralph Mormon?
That's Ralph Mormon.
Boy, some great pipes on that.
Yeah, he's a good singer.
You know, Aerosmith and then, wound up recording that later.
That's right, and that's a really good version of that, too.
Was it Done with Mirrors?
Yeah, I really like the Aerosmith. Yeah, because in 84, that
Although
came
I think
out.
I like Ralph Mormon's vocals better than Stevens on that song.
Yeah?
I really do. I love Steven Tyler, but man, I do really like the vocals on that.
They're both pretty rocking and either right. And,
it does sound like an Aerosmith tune.
And, you know, Joe Perry sings a lot of the songs on the Joe Perry Project stuff, and it's, of course, obviously the guitar work's all killer on there. So, definitely worth checking out.
All right, so as I mentioned a minute ago, look at my list. Judas Priest came around a lot sooner than I thought.
I knew they'd be back.
Yeah, I know
I told
are.
You they'd They're come back. Back up.
So, yeah, British Steel comes out on April 14th. Their sixth studio album released on Columbia Records, produced by Tom Allom. I feel like I'm repeating myself. Recorded at Tittenhurst Park, which is also known as the home of Ringo Starr.
That's right. Yeah. That's a cool story.
And they did it. Yeah, because there was like no sound effects back in those days. So like you had to create your own. So for Metal Gods, they had like trays of cutlery being, you know, slammed around and stuff.
Spoons and forks and shit.
So yeah, who knew that silverware could be so hard rock, you know?
Well, but, they are metal.
So, but this tune that I wanted to play, this closes out the record and it's a tune called Stealer. Good old British Steel.
You gotta love it.
Yeah, that's one of their best albums for sure.
Well, if you're going to talk about the new wave of British heavy metal, you're talking about Judas Priest. I mean, 1980 is the year when all that's really coming together. And we've had some really great new wave of British heavy metal discussions here on the Decibel Geek podcast in the past. But, you know, if you're going to talk about all that, of course, you got to talk about Iron Maiden because... Even though it may have only took 13 days to create it, the lasting effects of Iron Maiden's debut album would resonate for generations. In 1980, the new wave of British heavy metal is just starting to bubble over. And prior to 80, Judas Priest, UFO, Thin Lizzy, and Motorhead were kind of leading the way. But by the time 80 hits, the European underground metal bands are starting to rise to the forefront. The recording of the album came under less than favorable conditions, and the rough production doubled with Paul Di'Anno's unique vocal style gives the Iron Maiden debut a distinctive punk metal sound. You know, just before the album's release, Maiden's opened up for Priest during the British Steel Tour. We just talked about that.
What a tour.
And after its release, they hit the road with Kiss for the European leg of their Unmasked tour.
That's right.
By 1981, they would hire Adrian Smith, release their follow-up Killers, fire Paul Di'Anno, and hire Bruce Dickinson as replacement, and the rest is heavy metal history.
Can you imagine seeing Priest and Maiden on the same bill?
In 1980? Jeez. Or 79, yeah. Or whatever that was? Can you imagine seeing Iron Maiden opening up for Kiss in 1980? What a clash.
And with Kiss's repertoire at the time...
Didn't they learn their lesson? Didn't Kiss learn their lesson from just happened yeah. to you with Priest? Well, let's try it with this other band.
Let's have this band come and blow us right off the stage.
That's a bad idea, Curly.
Yeah, I know. All right, so my next pick, anything related to Thin Lizzy, I'm going to jump on. So I know sure it. Aaron knew I was going to pick something.
Well, obviously, yeah. I mean, if we ever do anything that involves anything that's got Thin Lizzy involved, I'll just leave that to the experts.
Well, because they're not going to get played on the fucking radio, so we have to do it here.
Right.
Phil Lynott, if you don't know, was from Thin Lizzy, put out his first solo album in 1980.
If you've been listening to the Decibel Geek podcast for any amount of time, you spent any amount of time with Chris, you know that.
We have a couple of guitar player friends we have to get over here to discuss Thin Lizzy one of these days.
Yeah, for sure.
But he put out his solo album, Solo in Soho, on April 18th. That's my brother's birthday.
Oh, right on.
And current and former Thin Lizzy members guest on the album, including Scott Gorham, Brian Downey, Snowy White, and Gary Moore. And Brian Robertson also contributed to the writing of Girls. The song Tattoo, Giving It All Up for Your Love, was eventually covered by Huey Lewis and the News on their album Picture This. And Huey actually appears on harmonica on some of this album, too. And he did on some of Thin Lizzy stuff, too.
That's cool.
Yeah. And
I never knew he was cool. Now I got to look at things differently.
This song from the album kicks off the album. It was co-written between Phil and another name you've probably heard, Jimmy Bain. And it's called Dear Miss Lonely Hearts.
Dear Miss Lonely Hearts, I had to write this letter to tell you how I came to meet her. She was sweet, but I dated her sister. That's how I made my mistake, and I can't forget her. I felt depressed till a friend of mine suggested that I write you this address. So unless you can find a cure for my loneliness, it will persist, it will persist. Lonely boy, looking for another. Lonely girl, to love one another. Lonely heart, turn to each other. Lonely soul.
I drink Dr. Pepper, don't you know? It's the original taste that I love so. And the taste is making peppers everywhere I go. There's guitar pepper, star pepper.
Next to a strike, here's what I like.
Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Tall peppers, small peppers, we're all peppers.
Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too? Be a pepper, drink Dr. Pepper.
Woo-hoo! Here's a camera that's simple to use. You just aim and shoot. But of course you have to go get your pictures developed. Now this is the simplest camera in the world. Polaroid's one step. You just press the button. And the motor hands you a beautiful colored picture you see in minutes. Now, you can put this camera in your pocket, but with the one step, you can put the picture in your pocket. And a picture in here is worth two in here.
All right, you're listening to the Decibel Geek Podcast. This is 1980, and what a great year it is so far. Hey, man, we're in April, so I gotta just say, for once, my wife's actually going to listen to this show because she was born in 1980 in April. So happy birthday, baby, and Merry Christmas. I'm going to say Merry Christmas to all our friends and family out there listening to the show every single week. The holidays right now, they're in full force. Everybody's out there shopping. I mean, right now, pretty much, it's about Christmas Day. Everybody's got their shopping done. But you know what? There's still good stuff out there. You know, you don't have to forget about yourself. You might be getting some Christmas money. You got to find a good place to spend it. They want you to buy yourself something nice when they give you money. You want to get yourself something nice? You go to HK Collectibles, Inc. He's got everything you need. He's got you covered. Right now, he's got cool stuff like tickets from Black Sabbath in Detroit in 1982. Accept and Helix in Charlotte in 1985. How cool. Mm-hmm. And ZZ Top, Sammy Hagar in 1983. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's all available, all that and a whole lot more. Head on over to decibelgeek.com. Click on the HK Collectibles Inc. banner and do your shopping. Of course, if you're doing any Amazon shopping, you want to go to decibelgeek.com. Click on our banner right there. It's going to take you through. You know how it's done. Everything you buy, it doesn't cost you a penny more. It helps out the show. Enough said. You know how it goes.
Yep. And we get a cool list every month or every week of what you guys have bought. And let's just read some of the notable ones, because some people have definitely done some Christmas shopping through our link. In apparel, a women's long sleeve duster cardigan was bought. That's nice. DVDs, Axis Triple X Live in San Francisco Blu-ray was purchased. Insurgent on Blu-ray and digital HD.
Yeah.
And Pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd and Second Helping Live on Blu-ray.
Oh, right on. I bet you that's cool as hell.
I didn't even know that was out.
No, me neither. I want to see that.
I do too. In the home section, a Bird Rock home bamboo laptop bed tray was purchased.
Bird Rock.
Nice. Jewelry, a Box Dragon Jewelry stainless steel men's ring Gene Simmons wizard skull was bought.
Nice. Awesome. Somebody's getting a really good Christmas
present.
That's kind
of cool. I'd like to have one of those.
Yeah.
Maybe I am getting one of those. In music, Little River Band Cuts Like a Diamond was purchased.
Okay.
Striper Fallen.
Right on.
Wasp Golgotha.
That might have been me.
Might have been you. Eric Clapton Sessions for Robert Johnson was bought.
Heck yeah, good stuff.
And then
and the Little River Band.
That's right.
I'm just teasing.
There's
they're
some good stuff there.
I know.
Outdoors, Coleman Packaway Kitchen was purchased. Somebody's going camping.
Yeah.
Toys, a bunch of stuff, including Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles sunglasses and Tower Puzzle was bought. But yeah, so thank you guys for shopping through our Amazon link, and we really appreciate it.
And thank you so much and for checking out decibelgeek.com. A lot of cool stuff there for you to see. Talking about toys and stuff, you know, it's Christmas time. Everybody's getting toys. Let's talk about the toys that are super popular in 1980, and here's a list of some of those. The Play-Doh Fuzzy Pumper Monsters. Do you remember that?
No, but that's...
I do.
My twisted mind really makes that into
it's
something
funny.
Else.
It's funny. Fuzzy Pumper.
A Fuzzy Pumper Monster for you right here.
Those are the things that were plastic, and they came with Play-Doh, and you put them in the barber chair, and you do the crank, and then the Play-Doh would push
through
little holes in their head, and then you got the plastic scissors to give them haircuts and stuff.
I haven't seen that since 1980.
I know. I think I had one in 1980, to be honest with you. Other good toys, the Talking Mr. Bill keychain.
Oh, no.
Mr. Bill. Oh, man. I love that stuff. When I was a little kid, I remember like my parents would watch Saturday Night Live and laugh their asses off. I didn't care nothing about it.
Mr. Bill.
Until Mr. Bill came on. Then it was like... to the TV.
Yep.
Loved it. 1980 brings us Mr. and Mrs. Potato Head.
Mm-hmm. Women's lib movement.
That was the year they got married.
Yeah.
You know? Happy anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
The Night Glow Daredevil Jump Slot Car Track was a big deal that year. Slot car racing. That's good stuff. This was one that glowed in the dark. You set it up at night.
Yeah.
I loved that when I was a little kid.
I had one of those electric race car tracks that would glow in the dark.
Yeah.
And it was great until my dog pissed on it and ruined it.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That'll do it.
You just sort of...
And that dang. That. Yeah. We had one set up in the basement. And it's like, you think about it now, it's just kind of dumb because all you can do is hold down the button.
Right.
And it just goes. There ain't no real racing
no
to it. Yeah. There's no steering, no skill. But when you're a kid like that, it's like, whoa, I'm doing this. Making it go. I can make it stop. I can make it go.
I can do both.
In 1980, another popular toy was Trixie the Playful Puppy. Any remembrance of that? It was a little dog. It had a string on it. You could like tug it once and it would walk, and you tug it twice and it would stop.
Really?
It's cutting edge stuff back then.
Wow.
The Cosmic Combat handheld video game, one of the very first handheld video games. I never had that
it's
one.
A Game Boy before Game Boy.
I remember this, but I never had it. The Big Track. It was a programmable RC tank. It wasn't like remote control where you could drive it,
right.
But you could like set it. You could program it to drive forward this many, you know, spaces, turn left, turn right, go this way, go that way, and you could set it up and then let it go. But you couldn't actually drive it. You could just kind of program it. 1980, a big popular thing was the Baby Chrissy doll. That's the one where its hair grows. That was one of the big gifts for girls that year. You pull the string and its hair gets longer, or you pull it out and I don't know. I never had one.
I was going to say, you know a lot about Baby Chrissy.
The 2XL robot with trivia cartridges. You remember this?
It sounds a little
It talks,
familiar.
It tells riddles, plays music, sings. It's got a little, like, 8 tracks you put in it.
I used to have it. Well, it was later on. It was a Teddy Ruxpin.
Again, cutting edge for 1980. This was basically Teddy Ruxpin if you just ripped the fur all off and had the robot skeleton underneath.
Put a metal cassette in and make it play that.
In 1980, obviously Star Wars toys are all the shit. That was all I wanted when I was 5 years old. That's all I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I think in 1980 was probably the year that underneath the Christmas tree I found the Darth Vader carrying case.
Yep.
Loaded with figures.
I found the TV commercial for that, and it's Christian Slater as a child in the commercial for it.
Wow.
Yep.
That's a trip.
See, I have more fun doing the research for these than I do anything else.
Totally. Yeah. Do you remember, now this ain't toys, this is more candy kind of a thing, but do you remember Chew Bops?
I have to because I'm a Kiss fan.
It was
very sought after collectible.
It was the first time I actually had one. I had one in my hands at one time, probably in 1980 as a little kid.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I'd ever seen the Unmasked album.
Yep.
Was on the Chew Box.
And
Chew Bops were they were little miniature albums, and the album record itself inside the LP was bubblegum.
Right.
But you would look at the album covers and they had like Judas Priest and Pat Benatar and you name it, they had it.
Yep.
It was a pretty cool thing.
It was a cool little concept. I liked it.
Heck yeah, I liked that too. Out of the bubblegum and into the metal. Oh yeah. By 1979, Black Sabbath were pretty much a shell of their former majestic selves. Once the heaviest and most intimidating band in the world, they're now widely considered has-beens, especially after being consistently shown up by their up-and-coming opening acts. See Van Halen in 1978. The endless supply of cocaine and alcohol didn't help their situation either. How out of control must Ozzy have been to make Tony Iommi, Geezer Butler, and Bill Ward say, "You're too messed up to be around us anymore."
Yeah.
That's a lot of drugs. And how strange is it that Ozzy's future wife Sharon is the one who suggests Black Sabbath carry on with former Rainbow vocalist Ronnie James Dio? Huh? The change in vocalist is a much-needed kick in the ass that this band needs to re-establish themselves in the world of rock and metal. And I think this is another case of they probably should have changed the name.
Oh man, I don't know. I like them better with Dio than I do with Ozzy.
Well, that's what I'm saying. And if for no other reason, which I always love Ozzy better, but for no other reason that the band sounds completely different than classic Black Sabbath. You know, from some of the things that I've read, I think Iommi saw Ozzy at the time as like the ultimate amazing frontman. But in Dio, he found someone who could charismatically lead the band, but was also an amazing vocalist and also brought in a better understanding of music and was more of a contributor to the band, you know, leading to the creation of this amazing album and basically making a revitalized Black Sabbath kind of an unlikely part of the new wave of British heavy metal. Yeah, they reestablished themselves.
This album and Mob Rules are just
amazing.
Incredible records.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This one. See, this is where it's hard. I was like, maybe this is album of the year in 1980.
It's got to be a contender.
For sure.
I don't know. I mean, we have the Herbie movie as the movie of the year. So.
Decibel Geek movie of the year. That's why this isn't a movie podcast.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, man, I would not want to listen to us wax about movies, no.
Uh-uh.
Okay, so for my next one, this is definitely not going to be a contender for Album of the Year because it's so far out of left field for what the performer was up to, but I love the album. Alice Cooper puts out his 12th studio album called Flush the Fashion on April 28th, and it was produced by Roy Thomas Baker, which, you know, that signals a change in style right there. No Bob Ezrin around for this one.
Right.
And the album delves into more of the new wave movement that was big at the time. And it's Alice trying something different. And, you know, a lot of times older artists that do this stuff will fall on their face, and some people might say he did with these albums, but I really have a soft spot for this early 80s period of music that he did, because while there were some clunkers, there's some also great songs from this time.
Yeah, for sure.
There's some great songs on this album like Clones and Grim Facts, and this one, this is Alice Cooper singing Pain.
That's a great song.
It's such a dark song, and it sums up Alice at that period.
It totally does. I love that song. And, you know, like you say, you know, there are some weird, like, kind of artsy,
it's
weird songs on there. But there are some really good gems. The songs that are good on those albums are really good.
Yeah.
And Flush the Fashion is a great example of that.
Yeah, it's a different album for him, but it's one, if you're an Alice Cooper fan, you should have it in your collection.
Most definitely. If you're a fan of rock, you should have it in your collection. Mm-hmm. All right, that brings us up to May. And one of the biggest stories, obviously, in the U.S., of course, in May of 1980, is the eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington State.
Yep.
With everybody, anybody that was alive that lived in the United States at the time remembers that story, because it was a huge ordeal. This thing kills every living thing within a 320-mile radius within 10 minutes.
Jeez.
That includes 57 people.
Catastrophic.
That's 320 miles within 10 minutes. Wiped out trees, animals, plants, everything gone.
It's like apocalyptic.
Yeah. I talked to my mom just the other night, and I asked her if she remembered that, and she said, yeah, even in Wisconsin, like the next days, you could see it. It was like a smog in the sky from the ash, just from the wind of how massive that was that far away.
Yeah, I remember we would go to my grandparents like every week, and I remember family talking about this when it happened. Like it was a big deal at the time. It was a scary thing, and I remember kids that were in my class would talk about it. It was a big deal.
Yeah, it was.
It may have been the biggest news story of the year.
You know, there's a video on YouTube, too, that talks about Mount St. Helens and shows a lot of that footage and stuff of
it's
it going
scary.
On. It is some scary stuff. If you want to check that out, it's available. You know what else can black out the sun? Saxon. Hell yeah. Saxon's been plugging away at the English metal underground since about 1976 and released their debut album in 1979. Like many of their other new wave of British heavy metal contemporaries, they're ready to burst into the new decade fast and loud, and they do just that with the release of their metal masterpiece, Wheels of Steel.
Oh,
man. That album is light years ahead of anything they did on their debut, and Wheels of Steel stands up against anything else that was gaining momentum coming out of the UK. And, you know, even though they never really got a lot of love in the United States the way that Maiden and Priest did, they were a damn good band. And they even caught a lot of shit in the UK at the time because the band members were all pushing about 30 years old by the time this second album comes out for them.
Elderly people.
Yeah, so they're, like, compared to like, Iron Maiden and Raven and stuff like that, these guys are old-timers. 30-somethings up there trying to be new wave.
And they're still doing it.
That's right. Unrelenting, Saxon would release the Strong Arm of the Law later on in the year. So they had two albums come out in 1980. And then they played with Rainbow, Judas Priest, Scorpions, and Riot at the first ever Monsters of Rock Festival in 1980. That's another big milestone in rock and roll coming up this year. And Saxon would go on to release over 20 studio albums over the years, including 2015's Battering Ram.
Mm-hmm.
Brand new stuff. Worth checking out. For sure. That's Saxon.
Cool. Well, another thing near and dear to our heart from 1980, video games.
Oh, man, this made me laugh when I saw it because I didn't know the story and I never would have thought of it. But on May 22nd, the Pac-Man arcade game is released.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know this? It was originally known as Puck-Man.
Mm-hmm.
In Japan, that was the translation. It was Puck-Man. But when Bally Midway Corporation in America signed it up and wanted to release it in the States, they changed the name to Pac-Man because obviously American punk kids in the 80s are going to get some spray paint and they're going to change the P
to an F.
To an F.
Fuck-Man.
Fuck-Man. So there you go. That's the story of Pac-Man, kids.
Well, similar to the story with Donkey Kong.
Yeah?
Donkey Kong, when it was originally developed, was called Monkey Kong, which makes more sense because it's a monkey.
Right.
There's no donkey involved in the video. Like, a lot of people wonder, like, why is it called Donkey Kong?
Yeah, I don't know.
It was due to, like, phone calls between Japan and America when they were, like, getting it ready to launch, and the person on the other end thought he was saying donkey instead of monkey, and that's how it got named Donkey Kong.
Oh, wow.
But it's supposed to be called Monkey Kong. Because it's like King Kong.
Right, totally.
Yeah.
That would make a lot more sense.
Well, yeah, that's why Donkey Kong's called Donkey Kong.
I like the story of Fuckman
better. Yeah, I think Fuckman's better. Somebody needs to do some nice Photoshop of what the logo would have looked like.
Yeah, what would it have looked like in 1980 would have been Puckman with an F.
Oh, man. All right, so I've got one more pick before I'm done for part one. Billy Squire's Tale of the Tape comes out in May. This was his first solo album after the disbanding of Piper, which was on Casablanca Records.
Yeah.
There's one Kiss connection.
Yeah.
Oh,
there's more.
And there's more. Keyboards on this album are handled by Richard T. Bear, who performed on Gene Simmons' solo album in 1978.
Yeah.
There's another Kiss connection.
Oh, there's more.
Lead guitar handled on this by a young New York guitarist named Bruce Kulick.
I've heard of him.
Yeah.
In the annals of Kisstory.
We've met him.
That's right.
This tune, while not a radio hit, has been notably sampled by hip-hop artists, including Run DMC, Big Daddy Kane, and Jay-Z for 99 Problems.
Yeah, that's true.
Among many others.
They say this is one of the most rap-sampled rock albums of all time.
Oh, yeah. I could have listed off another four or five.
Yeah.
And this is a song called The Big Beat. Legend Bruce Kulick and Billy Squire.
MC Kulick.
And a little quick note, I messaged Bruce on Facebook when we were getting ready to record this album and just said, hey, just wanted you to know I'm going to spend a little clip of something from Tale of the Tape. Great playing on that. And I got a big thumbs up from him.
All right on. That's cool.
So, Bruce, if you are listening to this, hi.
Yeah, what's up, Bruce? Hey, listen, we're talking about Bruce, we're talking about Kistery, and we're talking about 1980. Well, man, there's a lot going on in the world of Kiss in 1980, and I can't think of a better way to wrap up this episode. Before we get out of here, before we take the dive here into the Unmasked, let's go ahead and remind everybody, you want to check us out at decibelgeek.com. We've got amazing writers over there churning out amazing articles that you need to be reading. Year-end review stuff is coming up on the Decibel Geek website, so definitely want to get in on that. You want to make your voice heard? You want us to hear it? Go to Facebook. Become a friend of the Decibel Geek podcast. All you got to do is like us. Get involved in the conversation. You want to become intimate with Chris and myself. Real, real intimate.
I don't feel good.
Become a Decibel Geek VIP. And then you get the Chris and Aaron show. You get verses. You get guitar picks. You get t-shirts. You get, man, the list goes on. Go over to patreon.com. Check that out. Otherwise, it's all at decibelgeek.com. Mm-hmm. And that's all the time I'm willing to spend on that today, because now it's time to talk about Kiss. Oh, yeah.
They put out an album in 1980?
Heck yeah. The Demon, the Star Child, the Space Ace, and Anton are back.
That's right.
Yeah, up until after the release of Unmasked, nobody realizes that Peter Criss's contributions have been very minimal for a long time. There's been dissension within the ranks since before the release of the solo albums 2 years earlier. And Ace even said in his book that Pete really didn't want to quit the band and that Ace wanted to give him another chance, but Paul and Gene were dead set on canning him. Yeah. You believe that?
Ace eventually agreed with them.
Yeah, and that's what he said. You know, after a while, you just kind of go on, you know. And what would become a reoccurring theme over the next few years, Ace was outvoted. Oh, yeah, and the Catman was out. Ace was also outvoted on the direction and the production of this album, which ended up a lot poppier and a lot less heavy than what he wanted. And due to the escalating tensions, Gene Simmons doesn't even play any bass on any of the Ace-written songs.
I don't know that he plays much bass, period, on this.
Probably not. Ace plays it himself.
Busy boning Diana Ross during this time.
That's true. That probably takes up a lot of your free time.
Not that that's a bad excuse, but...
No, you know, and Ace really can probably, you know, obviously play bass pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
You know, even Paul was doing his own thing, like with Shandy, which was completed with all outside players. See episode with Tom Harper for that inside story.
Get to hear the original demo.
And the original demo. That was awesome.
Yeah.
It's a strange time for the hottest band in the world.
Yes, it is. Vinnie Pontius producing them.
Yeah.
And everybody talks about Dynasty being the disco poppy album. No, this one eclipses that big time.
It is.
Other than Ace's contributions, it's a disco album.
Yeah.
In my view, totally a disco album.
And, you know, Unmasked would be the first Kiss album not to rank the platinum sales status since Dress to Kill. It only reaches number 35 on the U.S. album charts. It was also the first album that Kiss didn't even tour the United States in support of, due to the album being much more popular overseas.
Yeah, it's stiffed here big time.
Yeah. With the exception of the single New York City show at the Palladium to introduce new drummer, The Fox, Eric Carr. Love that guy. Then after that, it's off to Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. And that would actually be, at the end of that tour, would be Ace Frehley's final full concert with Kiss, even though he sticks around with the band for a few more years. But as far as actually getting out and actually playing a full show, the Unmasked tour in New Zealand, that's it for Ace.
There's a soundboard recording of that out there if you can, you can look up, and it sounds great.
Yeah, Ace, I saw that on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very cool. I wish it was the video, but at least there's the sound.
Yeah.
You know, that's cool. Unmasked, it's one of them albums, a lot of dissension, you know, ranks. Me, I like it.
I've never liked it.
I wish they would go back and reproduce it and re-release it in more of a 70s style, you know?
There's decent, and it's a weird thing, I'm into pop rock, but I think the production kills it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, and I'll defend Vinnie Poncia on this, because, like, you know, he won't come on shows. We've tried to get him, and, you know, our friend, I think it was Adam Mitchell that stays in touch with him. You know, he's like, he doesn't, or maybe it was Tom, no, I think it was Tom Harper. He's like, I've tried to talk him into coming on shows, but he won't do it because he feels like he's taken a beating by Gene and Paul in the press about it. And he's like, let me make it clear, this was their idea. They wanted that sound.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to tell them what sound they can have.
They got each other. They outvote and out-Trump everybody.
Well, they're the ones paying the guy.
For sure.
But there are some great songs on there.
You know, if I met Vinnie Poncia, I would say, Unmasked, Resurrected. You think it should be heavier? Prove it. Go back, get the tapes, do what Bob Ezrin did, and rock that sucker out and re-release it. That would be the greatest thing ever.
I would definitely buy it.
But in 1980, if you're Australian, you're having a good time with Kiss.
You're at the peak there.
Heck yeah. So we're going to rock it out with Kiss. You know, you got to do it 1980 on Mass Style. And we'll be back for 1980 Part 2 right here on the Decibel Geek Podcast next week. See Merry you. Christmas.
When I see you, girl, you turn my head. You make me dizzy. I get a good vibration. When I look into your big blue eyes, I start to quiver and shake. I get a strange sensation. When you walk by me, you strut around, you make me crazy. I get no relaxation. Talk to me.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.